Great. Karen and Mark, come on up. As part of these big questions events, the questions are all very much to do with our real lives, aren't they? Things that affect us all in different ways. And therefore, one of the things we've wanted to do for every question we've addressed is to interview some people for whom it's been quite a real issue one way or another. And I've got Mark and Karen here. We're going to be hearing a little from James Cunliffe in a few moments as well. Thank you so much for joining us all today. Tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you both from?
I was born in Cape Town and I've lived there my whole life. We moved to the UK in 2000, so we've been living here since then, so about 15, 16 years.
Okay, fantastic.
And I was born in the UK, and at the age of 3 months, my parents moved to Rhodesia, which is now called Zimbabwe. I was schooled there, and I did 2 years military service in the Rhodesian Army, and then went down to the University of Cape Town to study, and I met Karen at a Baptist church where we got married.
Okay, wonderful. Tell us more about that another time. Now we're going to zoom back 23 years to 1993. You're both in Cape Town at that point. You attend a church called St. James's Church. Just tell us a bit about that church and your involvement in it.
Yeah, so St. James Church is located in a quiet residential suburb of Cape Town called Kenilworth. It's part of the Church of England in South Africa. It's a big church. It hosts about 1,500 people, and it has 3 services a day. And it's got a real cross-mix of cultures, ages, but it's a very vibrant evangelical church. My ministry in the church, yes, sorry. I was involved in the music ministry, so I'm a pianist and I used to play for some of the services.
And I was involved in the men's ministry and I served on the information desk and worked with welcoming newcomers to the church.
Yeah. And it's a big church, isn't it? Kind of 1,500 people, big auditorium.
Yeah. Huge auditorium, kind of like 6 times the size of this.
So, yeah.
I mean, it was designed that way so that the gospel could be said. There was a huge stage. And there were masses of people that just went round like that. Yeah. And it was set up so that people could hear the gospel clearly.
So when you turn up for an evening service on the 25th of July, 1993, it's just a Sunday, normal kind of Sunday for you guys.
Yeah, indeed it was. We'd spent a Sunday together. I come from a strong Christian home. We'd been to the morning service, and then we went back to my mum and dad. We had a Sunday roast. And we decided to go to the second service, which was the evening service, which was fairly normal for us. It was a dark, winter's nice, rainy, not very nice to go out. So some people didn't come out. The regulars didn't come out because the weather was so horrible. But we chose to go that night.
Mm. But as it turns out, it was going to be a life-changing day for you both. Tell us what happened.
So we were having a song item. It was a duet, which was taking place on the platform. And the auditorium had side doors on either side of the stage. And during the singing of the duet, a group of 4 gunmen burst in through the front doors. They faced the congregation and fired at us and threw hand grenades into the congregation. The hand grenades were covered in nails in order to do more damage, and they threw it into our midst. As we sat facing them, we had a sniper who was in the part of the gunman party who then picked off anybody who hadn't managed to get down or try and escape.
So the shooting ceased when a off-duty police officer who was a member of the congregation stood up and with a pistol and started firing back. 30 seconds is all it took. They left behind 11 people were killed. There were 55 people who were maimed badly, some of them for life. And there were some Russian sailors. St. James Church had a mission to Russian sailors. What would happen is the sailors would come from the Black Sea and go to the Arctic and replenish all the resources for the Russians doing the work in the Arctic. And they would use Cape Town as a base. And we had an outreach. We used to bring them into the church. We had a translator. She was stood up on stage, and they're translating. So it was
complete carnage in quite a literal sense. Can you remember What went through your heads as you saw these events unfolding?
Yeah, I think for me personally, I had never experienced violence like this. So the sound of the gunshot, I never recognized it as gunshot. I thought it was a firework explosion. I didn't realize what I was hearing. Mm-hmm. And it's a moment where you don't think. The adrenaline just kicks in. Fortunately, Mark pulled me and my sister, who was sitting next to him, to the ground, and we tried to get down in the pews. And I know it was only 30 seconds, but it seemed like forever. Mm. And all I can remember that when it stopped, the shooting stopped, I had my own nail marks in my hands from having held on so tightly out of fear and panic. And we just had bullets flying above us. We had skimming pews. We had people screaming. We had grenades exploding. We had the smell of gunfire, only to be followed later as the guns stopped firing. Eventually, we heard the sounds of sirens and emergency vehicles coming to the site. But those sounds, those smells, are forever etched in your mind.
Mm. Mm. So, I could not believe what I was seeing. I was now being thrown back to my military experience. So my military mode kicked in. I pulled everybody down. I got up and told people to get down behind the pews, because if they can't see you, they can't shoot you. Trouble is, the hand grenades were also doing the damage. I just saw these hand grenades coming up with the little silver things, because they were covered, and landing in front of us a couple of pews down. So, total disbelief. I mean, I just could not believe it. Once the gunman had left, I got up to survey around, and there were a couple of people that were injured, and I attended to one or two and took one down to the front, and then I tried to help some of the Russian sailors who the hand grenade had blown up underneath them. And
you know, here we are. Most of us will hopefully never go through anything like this. What impact did it have on you personally, I suppose, in the following weeks?
Yeah, I don't think you can ever be the same after an experience like that. And I had very little understanding of the trauma that I'd just gone through. So we left the church and we walked to the car, and we just agreed to go to my parents' house. And we got to my parents' house, and I remember my dad, who was always very much in control and a very strong person, for the first time, you know, sort of, he said, "Let me just phone your sister and tell her what happened. Your sister's in Johannesburg." And so Mark put on the kettle and gave us well-sugared tea, not realizing that we were in shock even. Well, Mark knew that, but we didn't. And he phoned my sister, and he said to my sister, "Just in case you hear anything on the radio," we were at church now. There was a bit of an upset, but we found, we absolutely fine. And we thought we were fine. We absolutely thought we had a cup of tea. And so then we went home, and we got home, and all of a sudden we switched the radio on, and we started hearing the reports, and now you had this insatiable desire just to find out how many were killed, who's been injured, do we know anybody who's been killed, and so you couldn't actually turn the radio off, you couldn't turn the television off as the live coverage started just coming at you. We then thought we could go to bed, not realizing that you can't sleep after something like that, and so we tried to sleep. I wanted to have the light on because I was scared of the dark.
And, of course, I'm in military mode, so I want the lights off so I can see the enemy coming. it's a strange sensation, but you...
So we couldn't really get it together. He wanted it on. We just couldn't sleep that night. Anyhow, my sister, she didn't want to talk about it. My dad didn't think we could talk about it. I needed to talk about it. So we had a real mix of emotions that followed after an event like that. Mm. We managed to get through Sunday night. We went to work on Monday, not realizing that actually no way could we do a normal day's work. So we were so unfocused. It was sort of reeling through the news. We had to leave work, and we just went home.
Mm. I think for us, it changed our life forever. I think we were emotionally, you're mentally scarred. And there are others in the church who were physically maimed, but there were about 3,000 members of the church, not all who come to the same service, and they were emotionally and mentally scarred as well. Mm. We suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's not something that I was familiar with when I was in the army, because they didn't have those kind of terminologies in the in the dark ages, but that's the kind of thing, like lack of sleep and being uncomfortable and not being able to sit. And then, of course, the total disbelief that somebody would attack a church. I mean, that's just unheard of. And the nature of the gruesome attack. So, you know, when they left, they just... Yeah. This damage was there. We just smoke in the church.
I mean, as you say, it's a church. Lots of people with a strong Christian faith there, yourselves included. What impact did all of this have on your faith?
I have to say, it shook my faith completely. I was completely shaken. I could not get my head around how this had happened. I couldn't accept that God hadn't protected me from this violent, vicious attack. And I was in his house. I was at church. How come he never stopped them? Was this part of his plan? And so what I believed as a Christian was thrown into sharp focus. And for me, I now had to try and stand on the promises of God that I knew and I claimed, but I now had to make them work in my own life. And I knew that I had to react differently to someone who wasn't a Christian, but my thinking was all wrong. I kept thinking that I shouldn't have been subjected to this. And because I was, God didn't love me, God didn't care. It's like good things don't happen, you know, bad things don't happen to good people, which is so wrong. And I realized that my whole faith needed to be shaken up, really. And I needed to understand that God uses good and bad, a sovereign God uses good and bad to bring about his purposes.
So in one sense, it deepened my faith, because I had to trust that God's in control of our day-to-day lives and also our external circumstances. It has to be balanced with the understanding and acceptance of God's sovereignty in our lives. Furthermore, you know, we're not immune from attacks of the evil like this, even though we're Christians. We're not going to be able to escape some of those things.
I mean, it's interesting. You put me onto a book which the pastor of that church actually wrote, a guy called Frank Retief, and he said in that, I think, that somehow it just felt like an invisible line had been crossed with these attacks. What do you think he meant by that?
I think it's a common... There were crimes being committed against most people, but in this particular instance, there was no political affiliation, and in fact, when you read his book, he talks about points being scored by terrorism for soft targets, and actually no political party wanted anything to do with this. They didn't want any of the political points to be scored. St. James ran an outreach to the black communities where these guys come from, which is probably the reason why they heard about the church. And the irrationality of it was huge. I mean, Mandela had just been released. Negotiations for the dismantlement of apartheid were underway. There was starting to set up processes for the general elections. There was no reason or legitimate act for it. But that invisible line that parishioners had been attacked was completely incomprehensible. The one thing I wanted to say, if I may, is that post the elections, they set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where people who had committed acts of violence during the apartheid era could go to this commission and they could confess what they'd done, and then based on what happened and the assessment of all the facts, they would be given a pardon. And so these four gunmen were given a pardon in terms of the TRC. The thing I want to kind of point out is that actually they got away scot-free, so they thought, because they got a pardon. But actually, God doesn't let us get away scot-free. There will be one day when God will ask us to come before him and explain some of our actions. And so while they... I mean, the one gunman was jailed in 2011 for his second or third robbery, his heist. He was put away for murder, robbery, and for arson. So... Even though he'd been pardoned, he still didn't get the idea that, you know, with pardon comes a responsibility. But Jesus Christ has taken that. He's the one that gives us a defense, goes in as an advocate for us in our defense before God.
Time is running away with me. Just a couple of questions as we close. I mean, lots of us will be aware of events like this going on in our own day and age. I guess the Paris bombings are closest to home for us here in the UK. When you guys read in the news of these kind of things, how do you hear it, given your experiences?
Yeah, I think what happens eventually, what you saw, which was so abhorrently abnormal, finds a place to sit somewhere in your psyche. In fact, the council has said that that's what will happen with time. It will sit somewhere in your psyche and you'll be able to have it there. But a flashback or a life-threatening situation for me still can do that. And watching it on TV, I can see it and I just know how difficult it is for those people. And so the empathy is there for the long road that they're not going to start walking.
Yeah, I think we have some great empathy for the victims of these attacks. Yeah. It does bring it forward again. And probably they won't ever, like us, we won't ever recover fully from it. Mm. The mind stores it away, but it doesn't ever go away. So,
one final thing. As Christian believers, given what you've gone through, what message would you have for us today?
I think the key thing is that, you know, we worry about things that we can control, our jobs, our health, our life, but actually all of those things are in God's hand. And we can't control those things. God was faithful that night, and he's brought us through it, and I can see how he's used the event. And he continues to be the rock upon which we stand.
Mm. I think for those of us who are Christians, we need to realize that God's in control, and he's divinely guiding events, and he will keep us safe in the eye of the storm. I think for those of us who don't believe in Christian belief and Jesus Christ, I think I need to urge you about the fragility of life and what happens when you die, whether this be in an act of violence or terrorism or a natural death due to age or failing health. I think one needs to...
And I think the big thing that we sort of took out of it, and it still is so true, the tragedy is not whether you die in an act of violence or of terror or of an evil plot that man can put together, but if you die without Christ, that is the tragedy, because we're all going to die. The method of our death is not known, or the process of our dying. But that's, for us, the biggest lesson, I think, that we learned from the massacre.
Mark and Karen, thank you for sharing. Let's give them a round of applause. And as you take your seats, I'm going to invite James Cunliffe to join briefly as we finish our interviews. Now, James, as you come up, your experience of this kind of thing is very, very different from Mark and Karen's, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, I feel hugely for the experience that they've described. I spent over 30 years in the British Army, three long tours in Northern Ireland, and combat operations in Kosovo and Afghanistan, and then more recently, robust peacekeeping in Congo. So I guess going into these places armed and trained and kind of prepared is completely different from being, you know, an innocent civilian in a church in South Africa. It's completely different. But, you know, we all have our frailties, and so we're all affected by people around you being hurt or killed. It's interesting that it's number two question in the Maiden Edby question. So, I'm happy to talk a little bit about some of the broader issues related to it.
And actually, I mean, it's interesting. Lots of the questions in here are to do with world peace. Why isn't there world peace? Why are wars bubbling away across the world seemingly endlessly? And just if you have to simplify and be quite short, but what are some of the root causes from your perspective of some of those conflicts?
Yeah, well, look, we all know the world's tough, messy, difficult, full of tragedy and hardship. But if I was just going to, in a very short time, and 5 minutes is never going to be long enough, to give you perhaps three ideas of kind of what are the levers, what are the kind of the causes of today's conflicts. If I could give you three. One is the continuing need for small groups to have political power. And I'll talk and give you some examples about that in a moment. The second reason is man's desire, if you like, to scramble for natural resources. And I can talk about that as well. And the third reason why I think it's Maidenhead big question is that sadly in today's globalized world, we do actually hear and perhaps learn much more about difficulties and violence around the world more than any generation before. So I can talk a bit about media and its manipulation. So if I could just touch on the first point, political elites around the world, particularly in failed or failing states, will do anything they can to hold on to power. We just have to look at Bashar al-Assad at the moment in Syria. He's been president for 16 years. his father for 30 years before that. He heads up a small Shia tribe of Alawites, and for 46 years they've been in power. And when you control all the levers of power, whether it's military or police or all government money, it's very hard to let go of it. And actually, the Alawites see themselves as a minority tribe. And if Assad was swept away, there is a genuine fear that all the Alawites, men, women, and children, will all be killed in retribution. So that's an example of the need for failing and failed states to have political power, and it's vested in small elites. And you can see it in other countries, Uganda, Zimbabwe, elsewhere, where there are powerful elites who are holding on to power.
Mm. Mm. Are you happy just to briefly touch on the other two?
Yeah, the other two points about natural resources. I mean, it's no accident that ISIS have moved some of their operations from Syria and Iraq to Libya. There's no accident they're doing that. Not only is Libya a failing or failed state, but also there's tremendous access to oil revenue there. They have captured the Sirte region where there's oil, and they can get access to the oil and to the money that flows from it. And so this is an example of what appears to be a terrorist group for all sorts of ideological reasons. Mm. We get the message. The reality is that they are growing their power and doing it through wealth generation. Mm. The pirates off the coast of Somalia, the same. They want money. Mm. The rebels in Congo, they want to control the mines that control all the access to coltan and diamonds and so on, where they can actually extract money and power from the natural resources. So again, these are the main drivers for international conflict. And look, the third point, very quickly, is that today's modern media, and we've all got them. We've got mobile phones made from coltan extracted from mines in Congo. But we've also got access to constant information. Mm. Many of you will be LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Twitter, and all the other things. And people can hear, they can certainly hear the extreme militant jihad kind of messages. And vulnerable people are taken in by it very quickly. Mm. And so there's a real, real need to keep, what one's hearing in perspective. Mm. Not taking anything away from what Mark and Karen went through. The reality in the continent of Africa is that huge more numbers die every week from disease, from malaria, from traffic accidents. Thousands more die than from terrorism. And yet we're always kind of hearing the messages about the latest terror atrocity and everything. So I think, we've all got to be careful not to be swept away by some of the media messages we're getting. It's a tough, difficult world. There's sin in the world, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it here. And I'm afraid there's no immediate chance of that ending. So some of the questions about why won't it stop, I'm afraid goes back to sin. Mm. But I think in my experience, I'm sorry I've spoken for too long, my experience is actually there's quite a bit more good than bad in humanity. So I think we should be positive as well, as aware of what's going on around us.
James, thank you so much. And thank you, Mark and Karen. And that's all from us.